There is a sixth dimension beyond that which is known to reasonable man. It is a dimension as vast as Gallagher's talent and as timeless as when Justin met Kelly. It is the middle ground between good taste and terrible judgment, between flops and fiascos, and it lies between the pit of puny man-animal's fears and the summit of Oogie Love's knowledge. This is the dimension of grudging toleration. It is an area which we call Nathan Raven's Happy Cast. Listeners, and welcome to the latest episode of Nathan Rabin's Happy Cast. I, alas, am not Nathan Rabin. I'm Clint Worthington, senior writer for Consequence of Sound and film and TV critic slash podcaster extraordinaire.
Quantity, quality, you have them all mastered.
Mostly the former.
I think you should call yourself Pod Master.
Perhaps.
Master of the Pod.
Perhaps. Well, I've already got my hip hop name, which is Seaworthy.
There we go. I like that. I like
that. Oh, that's solid, yeah.
That was gifted to me. I can't even take credit for that.
Mine is Flobama.
I love it.
I'm the president of Bustin Dope Rhymes.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense.
Thanks, Flobama.
Oh, and also I tragically remain Nathan Raven, intern and proprietor of Nathan Raven's Happy Place.
Quite so. And we have a very special guest, one of our favorite film critics, one of our good friends, Charles Bermesco. Say hello.
Hey, everybody. That's awful nice of you to say hello.
Well, yeah. And I actually met you when you were an intern at the Dissolve.
That's right. I was but a young babe in the cradle.
You
first,
were. You were. You were like 20, 21 years old.
I was 21 at this time. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy. Yes.
Where does the time go?
I'm barely legal and ready to party. Which at 9 in the morning was a little bit aggressive and a little bit weird. Yes, and that you would just bring Jägermeister. I think it reflected well upon you.
Yeah.
Yes, and you remain a pop culture wunderkind. Where do you write?
I'll take it. Yeah, wunderkind sounds pretty good to me. I am regularly appearing at The Guardian. I write about movies for The Guardian. I write about movies for Vulture.com. I write about movies for Mike and occasionally The New York Times.
Ooh, fancy.
I'll go wherever they'll take me. I'll tell you what.
We've got quite a good episode for you. This is one for the kiddies. This is one for the kiddies this time around. Because we're talking about a lot of Disney, Pixar, and Pixar adjacent stuff, like Incredibles 2. Sorry, not The Incredibles 2. This is like Ang Lee's Hulk to The Incredible Hulk. And then we're going to talk about Inside Out. We'll take a little bit of a look back at a good Pixar movie, and then a bad Pixar adjacent movie with Planes, Fire, and Rescue.
Boo! I'm not going to tip my hand, but boo! Boo, Fire and Rescue!
See, you say that like someone who's never needed to be rescued from a fire.
Right?
Clearly.
Yeah.
That's true. I have needed to be rescued from tired formulaic storytelling.
Oh.
By myself, by turning this off and going to bed.
Oh. Planes 2 dares to ask the question, what if only the brave was for kids? we'll polish off this episode of Children's Classics by talking about death and the way we respond to it, which is going to be great.
Whole lot of death going on. And I'm not just talking about Chris Hardwick's career.
Oh, no. But first, let's get into some scalding hot takes. In 2004, a little movie came out called The Incredibles, and it was, shall we say, superlative. And now there's a sequel, finally, like 14, 15 years later, after Brad Bird dabbled in live-action movies, and it's The Incredibles 2. What did you guys think of it?
Well, I was actually very confused, because I thought that it was going to be about The Incredibles, who are the Chicago Bulls cheerleading squad.
Oh, yes.
Of the 1990s, and there's literally no cheerleading.
This is some of that sarcasm you warned me about.
Yes.
I think it's more of just like a bad joke, more so than it is sarcasm. But no, I quite liked it. On the whole, I really, really enjoyed it. It, I've gotten insanely protective and insanely chintzy with my time. So I think sort of as a freelancer, as a dad, like everything I do is about time management. So when I saw that it lasted 2 hours and 6 minutes, I was not overjoyed, in part because I had to like come back home and look after my son. But it really, really makes excellent use of those 2 hours. It makes really, really excellent use of, you know, sort of the passing of time. Even though it doesn't take place 14 years after the original, there is this sense of loss, of pain, of you know, I feel like one of the great things about the Incredibles franchise, it's so, the world building is so magnificent. You know, it's everything is kind of built out to the tiniest little detail. And I like that. I mean, I kind of said this in my review that hasn't posted yet, but I kind of felt like in a weird sort of way, it reminded me of, you know, sort of like the television renaissance that's going on now. And that you have these characters that have these, this depth and this richness and these lives. And I almost felt like this was like the best possible, pilot for an Incredibles TV show. And one that would actually be like on Netflix, as opposed to being, I don't know, some sort of cheapo Disney XD kind of entity. What did you guys think of it?
I rather liked it too. I mean, obviously the Incredibles, I think, holds a very, you know, a very high place in the annals of Pixar, which is, you know, saying something really. And I just love Brad Bird as a filmmaker and as a visualist, like even in his live action stuff. I mean, I think like Ghost Protocol is actually, he's great. I think it might be my favorite Mission Impossible movie. And even like with Tomorrowland's significant flaws, there are glimmers of that incredible visual invention that Bird is capable of. And it's really nice to see him back in his wheelhouse, because he has that very Chuck Jones precision when it comes to visual language and the way things move in space and time. And The Incredibles 2 is great, especially in those action scenes. Like, you know, it's funny because I feel like, I mean, we're obviously in this glut of superhero movies now, especially since the first came out. So I was like, how is this going to fit in that prism? And it turns out they can deliver, you know, much more inventive action sequences than a lot of Marvel movies, and especially a lot of DC movies. Like, I'm just thinking specifically of that scene where Elastigirl is chasing the train in on her, like, bike that bisects to allow for her stretching. And it's just so vibrant and cool. I really, really liked it. And that extended throughout pretty much the entire movie. And I agree that it makes great use of its time.
Well, and I was reminded, too, that kind of Brad Bird, before he was sort of the king of animation, he was a very, very important figure in kind of the golden era of The Simpsons. And, you know, when The Simpsons was at its best, it was both hilariously funny and a very, very real emotional story about these characters who had greater depth, you know, and more humanity than live action characters, almost inevitably.
Yeah, true. Charles, what did you think?
I was taken with it. I'll say right now that The Incredibles is my number one favorite Pixar film of all. Actually.
Really?
Ooh. Yeah, yeah. And a lot of the things that endeared me to the first one are here as well. I think the score is probably the best in the entire canon of the Pixar score world. It's very zingy. It's got that kind of mid-century comic book feeling to it, which then extends also to the look of the film, which is something I just could get lost in, you know, and it makes it feel 2 hours. It makes 2 hours feel quite a bit shorter.
This was 45 minutes longer than Planes, Fire, and Rescue, and Planes, Fire, and Rescue felt twice as long.
But to be fair, there is much less Brad Paisley in Incredibles 2, which is...
And I like Brad Paisley. Like, he does some good, you know, traditional-sounding country songs.
Yeah.
Fucking garbage. His music, like, ugh. He's too power ballad. Ugh, I'm getting... here's the thing about me. In the 3 years since I was a film critic, when I see a bad movie, it makes me viscerally angry in a way that it did not before. I think I just accepted that bad movies exist. Most movies are bad. It's part of life. I think I somehow get indignant about it now. You know, I feel like, again, I feel like it's wasting my time in a way that it would not if, you know, this was still something that I did for a living.
I think this is what fatherhood has done to you. You feel as if your time is more precious now.
I think that's part of it. I think it also, like, I think I relate to movies in a much different kind of way. The first time I saw Incredibles, God, I was a long, long way from being a father. And here I really loved that this is a literally billion-dollar superhero movie. You have superheroes who can do anything. You have computer animation from Pixar where you can show anything in the entire universe. And literally half of this is about a realistic father dealing with looking after his children by himself. And they do it in not, you know, kind of a gimmicky, you know, shticky Mr. Mom kind of way. They do it in kind of a real, you know, the exhaustion, the confusion, the joy. Like, yeah, I felt like they captured that in a way that was as important to the story and to the arc and to the emotions as the superhero stuff. And I, as a father, I really, really appreciated that.
For sure. And I mean, even though I'm not a dad obviously yet, but yeah, I really enjoyed those scenes. It's really easy to make those kinds of subplots really tacky and like dated, where it feels like, I think I mentioned in my review,
where it's like a dad looking after kids. What?
He's so hapless. Gender roles. But I just really, I don't know. I thought they found a way to make it dated, and it was all, you know, he was able to adjust quickly enough that he didn't seem like a curmudgeon. He just genuinely didn't know why they changed math and, you know, these unprecedented problems, which I felt like it was a weird dig at like Common Core. But anyway, I just really enjoyed that.
Although the new math was also like a very 1960s, 1950s kind of thing. So yeah, that was like a very kind of old.
And that
concept
fits with a very Ken Adams mod sort of aesthetic too.
Yeah. Oh, totally. You know, and it's also, I mean, Craig T. Nelson does a fucking fantastic job. And it's also really nice to see people cast in roles because they're perfect for them and they have a lot of personality and they're great voice actors, not because they're Will Smith.
Or in the case of a lot of Pixar stuff, related to the filmmakers.
That's true. But again, I mean, we haven't talked about Bob Odenkirk and Catherine Keener.
Yeah.
Both of whom are fantastic. Do one of y'all want to kind of talk about the plot of this motion picture?
It's interesting because I feel like this movie sort of does that thing that a lot of these kinds of action movies do, where it's like, oh, we're going to have a vague bad guy, but they're going to turn out to be like this new supporting character that turned up. But I will say I was surprised that it wasn't both of them. I guess going into spoiler territory. But sorry if you haven't watched The Incredibles 2 yet. But yeah, it was kind of refreshing that there was a bit of a red herring where it was only one of them. And it related more to the fact that Elastigirl is at the forefront of this, where she gets... Like that was also a refreshingly kind of progressive move too, to like talk about the PR of representation, especially where it felt like it wasn't just a good idea because because we need more female superheroes, but because she does a better job.
Again, kind of, I guess we haven't really talked about the plot yet. So basically, like so many superhero movies, particularly kind of the X-Men movies, this opens in a world where superheroes have been outlawed.
It's literally seconds after the first one ends.
Yes. Yeah. Cause they create a lot of mess. They create a lot of problems. Ayn Rand would have had a lot of complicated feelings about them. So these superhero super fans who are played by, or voiced rather, by Bob Odenkirk and Catherine Keener, they come from a very wealthy family. Their father was very kind of obsessed. You know, sort of some people are obsessed with athletes, obsessed with their colleges. These are people who are kind of groupies, who kind of live to venerate superheroes, to hobnob with superheroes, to act as kind of advocates for superheroes. So they want to relaunch The Incredibles, and they want to relaunch superheroes. And again, there's a very meta kind of element to it where, you know, Incredibles 2 is relaunching The Incredibles. They're reintroducing the Incredibles. They're trying to make them current and contemporary. So one of the ways that they do this is they want Miss Incredible.
Elastigirl,
correct.
Elastawoman.
To sort of her be the new face, and kind of the person who, the bold kind of reboot. And again, that kind of sort of touches into a lot of stuff that we're talking about, sort of as a culture, about representation, about who gets to tell these stories, whose stories these are. So she basically goes and kind of relaunches her career as a superhero with the idea of doing such a good job that the public will be won over and they'll want to, you know, they want to take down this measure against them. And then, yeah, then the other part of it is that the father has to look after the family while the mom is out doing important superhero business. And then also baby Jack-Jack, who was a big fan favorite the first time around, is even more of a fan favorite this time because he develops all manner of impressive superpowers that kind of mimic the fact that, you know, when you have a baby, they develop all these incredible skills. You know, it seems like they're growing and developing and turning into something new and more powerful and amazing every single day.
I felt that this film went a little overboard on Jack-Jack, who
I could totally see that.
He was used sparsely in the first one for a comic effect, which is all fine. But and I'll say what, in this new one, his presence is not unlike that of a minion.
You've also spoken out against Baby Groot, have you not?
I have spoken out, yeah, vocally.
Dancing Baby Groot, right?
Baby Groot deserves to be in hell.
So you're against Baby Groot and you're against Baby Jack-Jack.
Baby Jack-Jack is...
What do you have against babies?
I am pro... Oh, God. I thought I was... I really thought I was going to be able to come
you're
up with a baby
raccoon,
that I
you?
Like.
Charles Probesco is for the children.
Oh God, do I like any babies? I like the baby geniuses. I like the baby boss. I like,
that's
I you like baby. You like baby drivers?
I like baby driver. Yeah, that's a great example. I like most real world
You like
babies.
Baby from Cash Money Millionaires.
That's
and
also
the Big Timers.
And I like baby house. Face.
Yep. You want to kiss baby
but
or
no,
something?
No, I don't know. I just feel like, you know, in animated movies, especially stuff for kids, there's a big impetus to sort of go after that register of, you know, sort of hyperactive, yeah, hyperactivity really being the defining criteria of these goddamn godless minions. And
although I did like that at one point, Jack-Jack, when he's feeling really, really angry, he turns into a demon baby. Although I have actually just watched Inside Out as well, which I'm kind of like, yeah, that sounds a little bit familiar there. Because again, babies can be, and I also like that there was actually a different voiceover artist for the demon baby. And yeah, I think kind of watching it as a 42-year-old father of a 4-year-old, I thought, oh my God, my 4-year-old is going to fucking love this. And then he's going to angrily demand that I purchase all of the merchandise related to Baby Jack-Jack. So yeah, I think kind of I see movies much differently now than I did when I was a single dude in the 1920s. When I was a time-traveling single dude in the 1920s.
Right. And Charles, I see where you're coming from, I think, with your impulse against like Jack-Jack and Minions and Groot and stuff. Because I do, sometimes it does feel in those movies like those are isolated things that are sort of shoehorned into the flow of a movie. Like they feel like their own set pieces. Like that one like chipmunk looking thing in the Ice Age movies, like it had its own little subplot. So yeah, I do agree. Like sometimes Jack-Jack like feels a little superfluous depending on where he is in the scene. But I guess it worked for me because I'm not a monster.
Well, I'm also I'm a sucker for adorable things.
Yeah.
And Baby Jack-Jack was fucking adorable.
Well, and it worked insofar as it related to Bob's journey, right? Because it is this unpredictable child on top of like dealing with these teenagers, which honestly, like Dash doesn't get a lot to do. He's just like the obnoxious kid who presses too many buttons. But then Violet gets this little subplot about, you know, and I guess it relates to like whenever dads have to deal with raising a teenage daughter too, and not knowing what to do about the whole boys question, or just a whole romance question in general. And so his attempts to like help repair this situation are so well-meaning but so disastrous that I found it really appealing.
Well, and you also have this again, this kind of very intriguing combination of the banal and relatable, which is, you know, girl has a crush on a cute boy who asked her out, and she's, you know, kind of dizzy for him with, you know, the fantastical element of her, the boy's memory was erased by a Men in Black figure who's actually voiced by Jonathan Banks. I guess one of the bird relatives, or not one of the bird relatives, one of the animators did him in the first movie. But yeah, so that's also like with Inside Out, it's kind of interesting how in tuned Pixar is to the emotions of teenage girls.
Yes,
it's a complicated and amazing place.
Yeah, it's true. Did anyone else notice this going back to like the A plot about legalizing superheroes? I feel like there's a weird trend in movies and TV shows, especially in the last couple of years post election, to shoehorn the phrase "make noun verb again" into dialogue. Because I noticed it like a ringing
who
bell
said
whenever
that?
I heard.
Who said it?
Bob Odenkirk does when he's like, "Make superheroes legal again." And I'm just sort of, for some reason, that stuck out to me as a sore thumb, and it kind of feels like a weird sort of like California progressive, like Hollywood signpost to be like, this is where you should be worried about a thing. And I don't know, it's just that specific verbiage. I don't know if maybe it's just been ruined for me.
I hate things becoming a way again.
Yes. Well, that's interesting. Is you kind of, if you go back and look at the 19 or the aughts, where so many terrible, terrible movies, particularly documentaries and, you know, scathing comedies, made just these incredibly clumsy attacks on Bush that A, didn't do any goddamn good at the time, and just make them look so ugly and dated and dumb now. And it felt like we kind of had an 8-year moratorium from that with Obama, sort of like with Clinton. You know, you kind of have these sort of idealized Obama figures. Probably my favorite is Jamie Foxx. Sneaker wearing, bazooka shooting,
bazooka
awesome,
Obama.
Cool. Yeah, bazooka Obama. I like that there. Yeah. So yeah, I think now you're having a lot of, you know, sort of Trump figures because, but again, you're not doing anything. I think this is probably a good segue into what do you guys think of this in terms of Brad Bird objectivist, Brad Bird libertarian, Brad Bird fellow with complicated politics that inform his movies in a way that, I don't know, irritates people. I mean, this is a movie with a lot of talk about weighty philosophical issues. But at the same time, I did not feel like it distracted. I did not feel like it was heavy-handed. I felt like it's actually kind of complicated and ambiguous, and you can definitely see a lot of objectivism in Brad Bird's work. But I think it's a lot more complicated than that. What did you guys think?
It's interesting. Like, the one thing I keep thinking of, I felt like this movie was sort of less nakedly objectivist than like this, than the first Incredibles and a lot of other Brad Bird work. But I did find it interesting that like the screenslaver's philosophy was a little, what was sort of relatable in terms of understanding the role of superheroes in society, where we sort of look to these heroes as these people who can solve our problems for us instead of us having to do the nitty gritty of actually solving it on our own. And the movie doesn't really like challenge that so much, but I mean, it doesn't also support it. So it felt like a weird throwaway thing, like that this speech that the screenslaver is giving, like it feels like it's touching on a theme, but it doesn't tie back into the rest of the movie.
I wrote about the whole objectivist business back at the last website that you and I worked together, Nathan, at The Dissolve. I wrote about the objectivist reading of The Incredibles and how Brad Bird has sort of disavowed this. He is a self-declared centrist, I believe, and he is...
Boo centrism!
Yeah, no, I feel that.
Anybody who doesn't agree with my political beliefs, whatever they are.
No, yeah. I see a deep, deep vein of empathy and kind of soul sickness in both the new one and in Incredibles 1 that kind of contradicts that sort of survival of the fittest, everybody get their own message.
Well, it's also about a family. Works together to do things. And I think there's definitely, you know, the cult of the individual is not as strong when you're talking about a couple and then beyond that, a family who have to work together. I definitely think that, you know, that's kind of an unfair label that has kind of been slapped on his work, but not entirely without cause.
It's true. But I also think, I agree with you guys that it feels kind of like a symptom of our desperate need for hot takes. A little bit. I mean, in a segment we're calling scalding hot takes, like it feels weird to refute it, but like it's just, you know, sometimes it feels like the objectivist label is sort of misapplied or at least applied too severely, where, you know, something can have overtones if you look deep enough, but it's not like this hidden subversive political message, you know, like I think the overarching themes of, you know, togetherness and empathy and trying to restore you know, a sense of equilibrium to a society that unfairly classifies other people. Like, I think just really, it's kind of with the X-Men, the superhero label sometimes interferes with the other, you know, the other makeup of it being like a marginalized group.
And I think just kind of like an overarching thing, the idea that, you know, the most impressive and remarkable and incredible people in society are being held down by regulations, being held down by the need, you know, for everybody to. Yeah. It's complicated. It's very, very complicated,
sure.
Definitely. And it definitely does not inform the movie in an obnoxious way.
Right. And I think it's better to say the movie's complicated rather than this is an objectivist screed, ignore it.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
absolutely. Nuance, what's that? anyway, do we have any other final thoughts on Incredibles 2? I mean, I think we all really liked it. It's a fun little lark. What did we think of the short beforehand?
I was about to say, I thought it was fucking lovely. And another beautiful, beautiful, very Pixar sort of exploration of mortality, of aging, of death, of fatherhood, of, you know, letting go. It was a lovely, lovely, lovely story. I never thought that I could be so incredibly moved by the adventures of a sentient steamed duckling.
You heard it here first.
But I was.
Nathan Rabin,
I was.
Nathan Rabin loves eating children. You heard it here. Yeah, I thought it was really sweet too. And it reminded me of it feels like Pixar is doing a really interesting thing in letting the shorts be the showcase for minority representation too. And like letting designers and developers and filmmakers of color tell their stories of their culture in this way that gives it a really big avenue and a really big audience, like Sanjay's Super Team. Like, it reminded me a lot of that.
Having this window.
I love Sanjay's Super Team.
What was that?
I said I loved Sanjay's Super
Team. Yeah, so did I. And I loved Bao. And they feel like these very intimate, very symbol-heavy explorations of the immigrant experience too, which is also very important to talk about now, like where these relations between like first and second generation immigrants and how they relate to their home culture and assimilation and that kind of stuff. It's all really, really elegantly and economically done, which is
really
nice.
I feel like Pixar is trying to be a good citizen of the world right now, and that has never been more important. I wonder if the conservatives are like, meh, a bunch of SJW butthurt liberals, oppressing the white Christian straight man by not focusing exclusively on
owning the libs by not bringing your child to see
depriving them of joy.
Right. All right. Well, with that out of the way, let's move on to some takes of a slightly lower temperature. All right, it's time for Lukewarm Takes. This isn't the only Pixar movie we're talking about. We're going to talk about basically the last one to make me cry, which is Inside Out. What made you want to choose Inside Out for Lukewarm Takes?
Well, I had been intrigued by Inside Out for a very long time. It's, I think, probably one of the best received, one of the most acclaimed and beloved Pixar movies. And the reason that I did not see it when it came out is that I did not think that I would be able to emotionally handle Inside Out. I kind of realized that I kind of look at my emotions, particularly sadness, as kind of this Pandora's box. And once they open, you know, all of this ugliness and weirdness and blood and guts and whatever, you know, kind of will come pouring out. So I'm terrified of my emotions, and I thought that a movie as emotional and poignant and intense as Inside Out would reduce me to tears and leave me in tatters, and that's exactly what happened. I was blown away by this movie. It's definitely top five, if not top three. It's funny, you can't be on the internet and not internalize this idea that every Star Wars movie must be ranked, every Marvel movie must be ranked, and every Pixar movie must be ranked, and that these rankings have some kind of meaning. And people get angry about these lists and stuff like that. So I think it'd be Black Panther, Last Jedi, Inside Out, Avenging Disney God. Okay. I loved this movie, and I was racked with emotion towards the very end, and I was sobbing throughout.
I remember I was really taken with the novelty of the concept. I thought that this was such a clever idea, and it was so, you know, Pixar's whole strength is the generation of poignancy, and, you know, they've got this big emotional engine that's always, you know, kind of grinding away, and this is really when it is firing on all cylinders. This movie, I got verklempt, as they say in Jewish faith. Yes.
Charles, I have two words for you in regards to this being a very original idea. Herman's Head.
I have not seen Herman's Head. I've heard about Herman's Head.
You say you haven't seen it. You're a hip. You're, you know, a culturally aware person, yes. And yet you say you've never watched Herman's Head.
Yeah. I think it's more famous as a Simpsons joke now than as an actual show.
Although it's funny because Hank Azaria, he was like the womanizing best friend on there, and it had the exact same fucking concept, which is, I believe, it was William Ragsdale. of Fright Night fame. And he was like some lame dude, and you could see inside his head, and it's like, I don't know, a gross dude and like a uptight lady. And then, I don't know, some dude was farting or something. It wasn't a very good TV show is what I'm saying. But they kind of take this idea and run with it in Inside Out, which is about, it takes place inside the mind. Well,
the way they visualize it is really where the whole movie lives.
Oh, you know, yeah, very much so. It's so lovely. Yeah.
The subconscious psyche. Oh, I loved it. The sort of, these huge gaps between the spaces in the brain is suggestive of, you know, amorphous spaces between cognition and memory. Oh, I thought that was really, really clever stuff.
Yeah, I mean, the mind, again, just kind of visualizing it on such a grand scale, on such an epic scale. And there's so much humor, so many wonderfully relatable moments. Like, one of the things that happens in this incredibly huge, vast, complicated brain that kind of handles everything is every once in a while, this little girl just hears a fucking annoying gum commercial. And that's so true. I mean, because I have like, God, I will have the same earworm, you know, just kind of, yeah, it's, I feel like I would need like a pneumatic drill, in order to get it out of my brain.
Just to reenact the ending of Pi.
Yeah, oh, and also, I mean, I get to talk about, you know, sort of, emotional. So the great thing about this is that she's 11 years old, and right. She's kind of
the crucial difference between this and Herman's Head.
Oh, very much so. Yeah, that, so there's at this incredible crossroads, you know, where you're not a girl anymore, and these things that gave you joy and identity and were your rock and your stability and your security when you were a kid, they don't really exist anymore. And the cornerstones of your identity, the things that gave you joy, you know, they're all crumbling and you don't know what to replace them with. And everything is scary and terrifying. And I feel like this did justice to the complexities of the emotions of an 11-year-old girl, which is a fucking Herculean accomplishment. And yeah, I think it'd be hard to think of a more perfect or a more lovely or more heartbreaking sort of metaphor for the joy and pain and loneliness of getting older and coming of age and crossing that bridge from, you know, being an innocent child to being a surly tween en route to being, you know, an impossible teenager. So, yeah.
Yeah, and one thing I really appreciate about it is the way it treats emotional complexity too. Like, that's the ultimate lesson, is that especially this girl sort of, you know, again, growing up, allowing her emotions to become complex, and like that's visualized in such a wonderful way with those colored spheres that end up like encompassing two or more colors as well. Like, it's a great lesson, because at first you think, oh, Inside Out, like, you know, the premise is neat, but doesn't this feel a little reductive that like we're just pretending we have five emotions when there's just, we run the gamut. But by the end of the film, you know, as you know, that, you know, as we grow older and as we understand our emotions more and we start to experience more of the world and react to it, our emotions become more complex, and things that are sad can also be happy. And there's, you know, nostalgia and sentimentality and sort of, you know, a bittersweet nature to the things we experience. And the fact that they're able to work that into the plot, and it's not even just an emotional undercurrent, is amazing. And that was beautiful.
Yeah, I thought it was particularly kind of elegant, the way they kind of capture how memories change with time, and the way that we look at the exact same experience can be not just different, but completely antithetical, you know. It's kind of the same thing, like, you know, with like breakups or people who've died. I think of just things like, you know, when the Bill Cosby stuff came out, and I would look at his face, and before all this stuff came out, I saw his face as just this, just kindness personified, just joy, childlike, you know, gentleness. And then when it came out, I remember just seeing this mask of awfulness, just this hypocrisy, just this evil, and how, again, same face, same things, but because of what we know and because of the road that our lives have passed, we can see the same thing very, very differently. And I think we also need to give props to Pixar for amazing, amazing voice casting. The voice of Joy in this is Amy Poehler, who fucking epitomizes Joy, as far as I'm concerned. She's amazing, and she's so ebullient, and she's able to be joy without being sentimental and without being obnoxious and without being sticky. And also they capture that joy is a surprisingly complicated emotion, and sadness is a complicated emotion, and anger is a complicated emotion, and nostalgia is a complicated emotion. I mean, I almost felt like I wasn't mature and grown up enough for Inside Out, and that it has layers upon layers, you know, that I think I'd probably, you know, explore upon seeing it other times.
Right. And, you know, speaking of great voice cast, I mean, Phyllis Smith as Sadness is
Richard Kind as Bing Bong, the imaginary friend.
But it's just so amazing, like, because she's just known for being Phyllis on The Office. And whenever they were first, she wasn't even meant to be. She was just like someone who worked with them for casting. And then they decided to just give her this small role in the beginning of The Office. And that role grew and she became, it sort of felt like a discovery. And then she gets to do this. And there's so many layers to her performance. And she's able to nail that sense of sort of self-pity, but also when that turns around into hope sometimes, it's really, really nice. And I love Amy Poehler in this, but I think Phyllis Smith is like the real revelation in it.
Well, and also I think part of the wonderfully mature aesthetic of this is they tell you that sadness is necessary and anger is necessary. And, you know, you can't have joy without sadness. You know, or joy will not have its meaning. So there's this very kind of fascinating, and part of me felt like it's such a fascinating subject that you could just kind of have them be in headquarters, which is kind of like where everything happens. You don't need to have them like go out and explore the rest of the world. But that adventure inside the mind is so epic yet intimate, that yeah, I feel like that was brilliant. And Lewis Black is a very one-note performer, but he is anger, and he's fucking perfect. Like, you could not do better, and you don't need more than one note. I mean, it's not, you know, a central character. But yeah, I kind of felt like everything with this just felt kind of perfect. There wasn't really a whole lot that I would change. I also liked, you know, the kind of the cultural specificity of she was a Minnesota girl who was really into hockey and a little bit of a tomboy and kind of into these sort of traditionally male things. And then she moves to San Francisco where people are hip, and, you know, people start to really get into their own identities. And this thing that brought her joy and was part of her identity and healthy, becomes this kind of like a weird, embarrassing Midwestern, kind of thing. I felt like, you know, her relationship with her parents was nicely complicated. You know, they were drawn, not huge roles, but drawn with a lot of depth and a lot of empathy, and a lot of tenderness as well. Like, this was a family that really loved each other and was trying to get through, you know, one of those incredibly impossible, the most impossible thing in the world, which is growing up.
Yeah, and changing places too, like moving is in and of itself, especially when you're that age, at such a formative age, it itself has its own subtle traumas, I guess. And yeah, and like, I love that, unlike kind of the families in Toy Story and stuff, like, this is a Pixar family with both parents around, which I think is rare. And so you see, it feels refreshing to see that dynamic, weirdly enough. And you get to see the daughters, the girls, reaction to the parents fighting and their everyday stressors, and it has an effect on her. And so even when it feels like the B story, even though she's the thing that contains the A story, they both inform each other in really interesting ways. And I don't think you could do you couldn't do a version of this that just takes place inside her head.
Right. I think that would be a little bit claustrophobic. And again, I think they found ways to visualize sort of these incredibly elaborate and complicated mental processes in ways that are like, yeah, very kind of unique and outside the box. I loved the look of it. I love the score. This had a score by Michael, what's his name?
Giacchino.
Yes.
My favorite composer and coffee beverage.
I loved his score in Inside Out, and I loved his score in The Incredibles too. They're very, very different, but they're also very, you know, very cinematic and very larger than life. And you don't really notice them except in a good way, which I think is the mark of a good score.
He's one of my favorite composers and has been for a long time. I really stand hard for his John Carter score. I actually think it's like, it's so good. It feels like a lost John Williams score.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like I heard a sigh out of Charles when I mentioned John Carter. What do you think?
I love Giacchino Giacchino. I don't know. I like his score for Up very much. I think it's very sweet music. But I love Inside Out a lot. It is perhaps the Pixar movie at which I have cried the most. I'm not afraid to admit that. It really got me right in the emotions.
To put things in John Green terms, I was feeling all of the feels.
I would,
watching
I
this
would,
movie.
I don't know that I would put it in those terms.
Were you shook?
Yeah. As my fellow millennials like to say, I was shook.
I have not watched The Fault in Our Stars, partially because I'll be overcome with jealousy, but partially because I feel like I'll just be like so overcome with emotion that like I will never be able to do anything ever again. And I felt like I had kind of a similar thing with Inside Out, which really was as emotional as intense. In a good way, though. And that's the thing, is I feel like, I don't know, I feel like I'm kind of repressed and afraid of my emotions in real life. But like when I get in front of a keyboard and I'm writing, like then I actually feel good about crying, and then I actually feel good about feeling emotions.
What I liked most about this film is that it's really all about embracing the unruly emotional parts of yourself and not sort of trying to regulate what you feel and when, and instead embracing all of the chaotic and the confusing aspects.
Right, embracing the mess.
Feeling,
which I think is especially
that's
especially important right now in an age where I think empathy is in short supply
now more than ever.
Yeah, exactly, and especially in an age where we're talking about incel culture and all that kind of stuff, like where
are either of you fellows incels?
I am. Yes, I am not one of those dreaded Chads that everyone speaks of. Yes, but no, it just, you know, in an age where, and this is weirdly why this isn't the purview of the podcast, but I was weirdly positive on Tag, because I think
talk about Tag here on the podcast.
I think the dude who wrote that
also wrote Beauty and the Briefcase.
And Wade, actually it's from one of the screenwriters. Which is surprising. Yeah,
I forgot about that. Yeah.
But I mean, I don't know, between that and things like Inside Out, I think we need more movies, more big studio general release movies that are willing to, you know, delve into that positive emotionality and teach people that emotions aren't a bad thing to have, and they are in fact good, and it's nice to cultivate positive relationships with people and also to weather bad times together. And it feels like a very unifying thing, and maybe just the horrifying events of the last 2 years have made me a big softy, but I think it just feels very necessary right now.
Well, there's also this idea that you cannot avoid pain or sadness, and also you should not try to avoid pain and sadness, because those are necessary elements of life, and that if you were to go your entire life trying to push those out, trying not to experience those emotions, you would limit the positive emotions that you feel as well. So again, I think there's an enormous amount of complexity and maturity to this film about the interior life of an 11-year-old girl.
Quite so. So we'll finish this section off with a quick question. On a scale from 1 to 10, how much did you cry when Bing Bong disappeared?
That is not when I did the lion's share of my crying. It is when she was like losing the capacity to feel emotions and stuff, when like the little magic ball was dying or whatever. Oh my gosh. Oh, forget about it.
Yeah. That's really rough too. Yeah. I cried no less than 3 times during the movie. And I think both 2 of those times were Bing Bong in that moment.
Yeah. I was very much towards the end. I think part of it was just like when the happy memories, I think, were sadder than the sadness, which I think in a way is kind of is the film's thesis. Because again, happy memories and sad memories, you know, it's the perspective that we have on them that kind of gives them, I think also it's an interesting way of looking at sort of these stories that we tell ourselves and these narratives. And with her, you know, kind of the narrative was, I was doing great when I was in Minnesota. I was happy. And then I moved to this weird place and now I'm not happy. Again, I think people, it's very easy to craft a narrative and then believe in it, even if it, you know, is reductive, or even if it's ultimately false, or even if, you know, it doesn't acknowledge the complexities of how life actually works.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also it also respects the pain that comes with loss, no matter how small, even if you're just losing your old environment or something like that, or you're losing your old childhood friend that you haven't actually like thought about for a while, but some exists somewhere in the recesses of your mind. Like, you know, you occasionally there's that feeling of remembering something that you didn't realize you'd forgotten until now, like something that, like someone you knew or something that happened to you years ago, like something that you hadn't thought about in years, and then you remember it, and then there's like a weird sense of questioning yourself of like, why did I forget that? And I just feel like this movie sort of is able to needle at those questions and those impulses in a really cool way. In addition to just being like, I don't think we'd be talking about in the way we do if it's just like this treatise on emotions. Like, it's still really thrilling, exciting, funny, bright children's film, but it's leavened with that emotional core.
Well, nice. Again, I think you kind of can't make a children's film that's not about people going on a great journey and an adventure and encountering obstacles and crazy characters. But the beauty of this film is that you're able to sort of combine it organically with, you know, this very emotional and this very true and this very sort of heartbreaking and heartwarming story about emotion, about growing up, and about, you know, sort of accepting loss and accepting pain and accepting a certain amount of loneliness as, you know, part and parcel of being a human being.
Right alongside bits of visual invention like building a ladder out of imaginary boyfriends.
Yeah. And
that room where they start changing their perspectives and like turning into different art styles, which was great. That's one of my favorite set pieces in that movie.
Yeah, and there again, just a lot of really, really clever gags. Like, they're going through the various worlds and they're like, oh, and that's Deja Vu World. And that's, you know, Goofy Land, and that's Deja Vu World, and that's blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, it's all good stuff. It's good stuff. All right. Well, we've finished, just worshiping at the altar of Pete Doctor. So let's move on to something a little less good. All right. It's time for Control, Nathan and Clint, and presumably Charles. What was on the docket? What were our choices this time around?
Oh, sweet blessed Lord. It was a pick your poison. Pixar is the best of the best, generally. So we kind of thought, what would be the worst of the best? And in the case of Planes, Fire, and Rescue, what is the worst of a spinoff of the best? oh, dear fucking God. The two options were Cars 2 or Planes, Fire, and Rescue, which is not technically a Pixar motion picture. And I fucking learned this by looking at my phone way more than I should have because I was so fucking bored by this movie. It's a spinoff of the Cars world. However, the only actual crossover is the character of Brent Mustang Burger. The silly day.
That's a joke on Brent Musburger, I suppose.
Who voiced the character.
Makes a lot of sense.
And it was more. So this was a sequel to a spinoff to, I believe, a sequel. Oh, Jesus fucking Christ. So,
Yeah.
So Inside Out had me feeling all of the feels. Incredibles 2 had me feel many of the
feels. Comparatively, I felt very few feels.
I felt nothing during Planes, Fire, and Rescue. It stars Dane Cook as Dusty Flubberhopper. What the fuck is his horrible name?
His name is Dusty Crophopper, which I maintain would be a phenomenal porn star name.
That actually is a pretty, pretty good, Dane Cook just sounds a little bit like a porn star name as well. Jesus fucking Christ. So people decided to torment us by watching this movie, which is not technically a Pixar movie. I believe it's called Disney Toons.
Yeah. No, it's Dixie Toons.
I would have preferred Dixie Toons.
The South will rise again.
That's if Tom Mater had actually, you know, been a huge presence in all of them. That would have been Dixie Toons.
I would not have been surprised.
Holy fucking Christ. So I do not like the Cars movies. I haven't seen Cars 3, which people really, really like. Have you guys seen the Cars 3 motion picture that people really, really like?
I have seen Cars once.
I've only seen the first one. And it's like, here's the thing, in a comparative scale, yeah, it's terrible. But like, in a weird sense, there is like there's a solid movie in there. It's just not really up to the level of Pixar. And then Cars 2, you know, pisses away whatever remaining goodwill there was by just doing a side little spy story with the most annoying character in the history of Pixar, Tomater.
Well, I like that the lovely, lovely people go like, well, we don't have Paul Newman anymore. He's dead.
Who What's can the we next replace? Best thing?
Who has the dignity, the gravity, the kind of cultural standing that Paul Newman had, but is still alive? And then they end up with Larry the Cable Guy.
The Paul Newman of our time. Jesus.
And I actually, I think Cars is...
To be fair,
Cars is not
a great
movie.
I think he also has a line of frozen food. So.
That is true. That is true. Not as good, I would imagine. No.
Paul Newman is an amazing
human being in part because he has amazing salad dressing. I cannot commend it enough.
And delicious lemonades, delicious salsas.
He makes excellent food. Very definitely. His pasta sauce is good.
Yes. Like award-winning pasta.
He was, and my whole thing is like, okay, when Paul Newman died, and Paul Newman was the heart and soul of the movie Cars, and there was something very nice about, because he was such a car aficionado, he was such a racer, like that was such a huge part of his life. It was just perfect for him to play the role of like the cranky mentor. And then when he died, that was a perfect opportunity to put this franchise to sleep. But I think if they had done that, they would have $10 billion less than they do now, because as the father of a 3.5-year-old boy, they fucking love this shit.
Kids love Cars.
They will
cars.
Watch anything. And watching this movie, I'm just like, okay, I love monsters. Like, I love superheroes. Giant. I draw the fucking line at cars. I draw the line at planes. There is something fundamental. Like, my brain will not accept a car, a sentient talking car, or a sentient talking plane as an acceptable character in a movie, let alone an acceptable protagonist in a movie. Now, if you were to give one of these awful talking sentient planes the voice and personality of Dane Cook, now I'm even less inclined to like this shit. There's just something, like, my brain is just like, no. Cognitive dissonance never ends. Yeah. I think part of also is like, I never stop wondering about what's going on in this world of nothing but vehicles. Abortion providers, are they also vehicles? Are the crack dealers vehicles? Like, what else is going on in this world? It invites you to think about all these, like, how do they fuck?
All the
implications. How do they reproduce? Are there human beings? What's going on with the, I think I just spent the whole time asking my wife, like, what the fuck is going on with this world of vehicles?
Right. Well, so let's talk about the specific questions that Planes, Fire, and Rescue asks of us.
And the narrative, off, of course, because it's a very, very big shift.
Yeah.
From
so to speak. Yeah, shift.
Hi-yo.
Speaking of which, just real quick with the rough plot, like, actually, there's a big similarity between Cars 3 and Planes 2 in that they're both movies about, like, what happens when an older vehicle gets put out to pasture, basically, where if you find out that the ex main character can't race anymore and they have to find a new purpose. So Cars 3 did the exact same thing. So I was kind of like,
well, it's like
chuckling
it's
a little bit. Planes,
that's
too,
a
the same
metaphor
thing.
For erectile dysfunction. Right?
Yeah, basically. But no, okay. So the world of Planes, right? There is a Native American character voiced by Wes Studi who has his own Native American myth. How closely does the history of Native Americans in America hew to them being cars and planes? Was there?
I've got a lot of questions.
Plane
about
trail of tears.
Well, there was gasoline. That was what the tears were.
I think that film makes clear that the planes absolutely have sex with other planes. Correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
Julie Bowen is thirsty.
She's thirsty.
For
oh
Dean
my
Cook.
God.
She's thirsty.
That plane over there. That's how the young people called them.
A teapot.
Yeah. Teapot. Yes.
Teapot.
That plane over there.
Oh man. There's fart jokes. There's a Howard the Duck joke that I actually kind of liked.
There is a surprisingly involved that. Chips parody.
As somebody who
Eric Estrada voices the other plane.
Kids love Chips jokes.
As somebody who has worked with Eric Estrada in the past and never misses up an opportunity to talk about having worked with Eric Estrada in the past, I was in a poorly rated, extremely disreputable basic cable panel show in Canada called Switch. It's like, we put the kit in your television pitch. And then we had a bunch of jackasses like me and then famous television people from many, many decades ago. So it was like Jimmy Walker, Butch Patrick, Eric Estrada. And Eric Estrada would not shut the fuck up. He was the most intense, obnoxious person I'd ever met. Like within seconds of meeting me, he like hugged me and started rubbing my head and pretending that I was wearing a wig. It was very, very strange. And he would not shut the fuck up about his job as an actual lawman. that he was a law enforcement agency and that he was involved in the cybercrime unit of like fucking Baltimore, someplace like incredibly, incredibly random.
So, I missed that season of The Wire.
Exactly. Where, like, Estrada did cyber crimes. And like the other people around there were like, I don't know, Jack Osborne, LaToya Jackson. They discovered that law enforcement wasn't for them. So they did not continue to have jobs as law enforcement agents after that. What's kind of interesting about that is it's kind of have a similar dynamic here where the, Ed Harris's character?
Yeah, Blade. Ed Harris.
Yeah, where it's kind of a similar
Blade
thing.
Blade Ranger.
Where they were doing chops and like after that show ended, he went on to do, you know, the kind of job that he was doing in that show. So I do not think that was a reference to Eric Estrada's second life as a lawman.
Do planes get paid? If so, in what?
That's a good
planes,
question.
What use do planes have for money?
Yeah,
it's kind of like
why do planes need glasses? Well,
have a kind of a utopian society going in which money is sort of a crass thing. I mean, what do you need money for?
Like when I would play Monopoly, I would always be the dog, because in like none of these other things are going to be able to enjoy having money. This dog, in a more abstract kind of way, like a dog has $1 million, that dog's living a pretty sweet life. It's kind of the same with, I think, why are you expecting me to care about these fucking planes? And there are so many scenes that are just like downbeat and dialogue heavy. And like, please, are you really fucking asking me to become emotionally invested in a sentient plane voiced by Dane Cook and his need to like get over his ugh. I was angry. I was bored and angry at the same time.
You were bangry.
I was bangry, exactly.
Another question I have is because a recurring thing with Dane Cook's character, Dusty Crophopper, is that he has a busted gearbox, which felt to me like an analog for, you know, like your heart's going out. Like you can't push yourself as hard as you need to.
And your dick doesn't work anymore.
But also it's always symbolized like whenever he is pushing himself too hard with like these readouts and these, the needles moving on displays in the cockpit of a plane that has eyes instead of windows. How does he see the readout? Why are they even there if there are no people? Did there used to be people? Was this a terrifying Holocaust? And now all that's left are the cars and planes left to enjoy the buildings and society that humanity set up.
So wait,
when does
now,
this take place?
In this world of cars and planes and whatnot, are there humans? Have we seen any humans?
There are no humans in this one. I kept looking, I kept asking the wife.
So what are the doors for?
That's a good question. Oh my God. Well, they're gonna say during the time that I spent in driving class, I'm trying to make good use out of all my weird random experiences in this podcast.
Sure.
I remember a lot of the videos were like children think that cars look like have faces, and the grill is their smile, and the lights are their eyes.
But sometimes the windshield is their eyes, so that's also confusing.
Yeah, and just the character design is so boring and so basic and blocky. They just give everybody giant fucking eyes, because that's
it's
what
very
kids
veggie
go for.
Tales.
Oh, it's really and I was saying, like, this is a movie where, like, if I saw the fucking Asylum knockoff, I don't think that would be that much worse than this.
Yeah.
To be fair, weirdly enough, like, there are a couple things that I actually liked about Planes too. God help me. Like, I mean, it wasn't like, it was boring and all that, and it had a really hokey message. But like, I found myself, at least during some of the like the rescue disaster scenes, thinking like, oh, at least they're filming this in kind of an interesting way, using like a documentary camera approach to capture planes in flight and things like that. And like, maybe this is me just like searching for things to like about it because I don't like hating movies, but I don't know. Like those bits, I'm like, okay, sure. Then when they get to the moments of shit,
I have one thing that I liked about it, and this is kind of speaks to how desperately I want to find something to enjoy about any movie I see, no matter how bad. When I saw Suicide Squad, I'm like, this movie is fucking terrible. But I enjoy that they play at least 7 or 8 songs I really like and that I know, and they play really long parts of them. So you'll hear like 3 minutes of like New York Groove, and I'm like, this is a horrible fucking movie, but I love that I'm hearing the song. One of the set pieces is set to the AC/DC song Thunderstruck.
Yeah,
which I will always associate with the Chicago White Sox because that gets played an awful lot. I think one of their and I fucking love that song, and I enjoyed that one set piece of them fighting a fire set to Thunderstruck, and I liked that they played all 3.5 minutes of Thunderstruck. It was like, oh, 20 seconds. They're like, you know what? This is a great fucking song.
If you're
going
to shell out for the rights to Thunderstruck, you're going to get
it. Fuck it, hey, man. If AC/DC are going to be playing Fire and Rescue, make good fucking use of that. Right. And also, like, I felt like, although that was also, like I said before, like, I actually like Brad Paisley, but my God, the two songs that he contributes, or the one song, or
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, it's like, could you write, like, a country garbage song, but about planes?
Fucking garbage, man. It's just and then so there's, like, boring and
that
sentimental.
Spencer Lee song when he's first showing up to the new place, and it's just so painfully earnest when he's, like, going through all the waterfalls and shit, and it's just like, oh my God, this is so,
yeah,
so corny.
And I like, and I really like Ed Harris has got a great voice. I really like Stacey Keach. But Jesus,
John Michael Higgins as the superintendent.
I felt John Michael Higgins was actually the only person who's like, oh, I'm doing a character. You know, I'm doing like one of the things that I would do on Mad TV or Christopher Guest movies or whatever. But yeah, but even so, like Hal Holbrook plus Stacey Keach plus Ed Harris doesn't equal one Paul Newman.
No.
And you don't have that gravitas. You don't have that one character that, you know, you care about, if only because you care about, you know, the person voicing them. And then also just the backgrounds, there's no texture to it. It's just all so lazy. And it's cost $50 million to make, which is about a quarter of a Pixar movie, basically. And you fucking get what you pay for. This looks like a really cheap knockoff where
it's
just
ready
took
made
of
for
scenes.
Walmart end caps.
Oh,
basically.
Totally. I mean, it should pretty much be direct to video. Except that it made $151 million in the theaters.
Yeah.
It's called The Lost Leader.
Yeah, I guess so. But I guess at least it's like an action disaster movie and not another stupid race movie. At least there's that, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. But I mean, I felt like I would have liked it better, you know, if it were more of a conventional disaster movie. Kind of felt like it was just like this weird, like, if Backdraft was about sentient planes.
I was going to say, it reminded me more of the Vincent Chase feature Smoke Jumpers.
Ooh, I like Smoke that. Jumpers, definitely.
Right? Or that one with Howie Long, where he was like
fire whatever. That's the name. Twin Peaks fire whatever was
fire whatever with me. Right, but yeah, and it reminded me a lot of Only the Brave, which was a movie that came out last year that was about like basically like Regina King's group of like the people on the ground who were supposed to like cut off strategically burn places in a forest fire to cut everything off, like, but that's like a harrowing drama where, spoiler alert, everybody but Miles Teller dies at the end.
No,
and this is Planes, Fire and Rescue. But yeah, for some reason it felt weird to me that it was like reminding me of that. And then there's like bits where Ed Harris's helicopter gets like horrifically burned, protecting Dane Cook from like fire in a mine.
Yeah. I cared so deeply during all of these scenes.
And remember the time that they dramatically just like put Dane Cook's character under the knife and like repurpose his entire body to be more of a firefighting plane? Like give him pontoons and cut off like the fuel tanks.
There's a lot of cosmetic surgery in the world of cars.
A lot of cosmetic.
I feel like that's
like really,
weird body.
Didn't really
horror,
have informed.
If you really
yeah, like he did not
it.
Have informed consent for that.
I mean, we get the impression that all of these procedures are, at least for the car, is painless.
Yeah, like the premise of Dane Cook's major problem is that they just don't make that part anymore for him.
Sure. Also, his dick doesn't work.
Also, his dick doesn't work. But also, they cop out on that, too. It's not like he just like has to learn to enjoy the rest of his days. Oh, no, Curtis Booger from Revenge of the Nerds can fix it. He'll just put together a custom gearbox for you. You're fixed! And like,
hey,
oh,
he's
God
one of our culture's
movie.
Biggest experts on Harry Nilsson.
Yes, indeed.
Say Booger and the dude who knows everything about Harry Nilsson.
Yeah, all right, fine. Sir Curtis Armstrong. But yeah, it's, I don't know. It's just, you know, there are bits I liked about it. I was just mostly admiring of the audacity of a Disney Toons feature to make a Howard the Duck reference.
Well, and also, I mean, I think that watching this in between Incredibles 2 and Inside Out did not do it any favors.
Yeah, the bar
because
was
those are
high.
Great movies that are very ambitious, very visually dynamic. They have a lot going on. I mean, you know, and now they also have a psychological depth that made the many boring, inexplicably kind of somber scenes in Planes Fire and Rescue seem even more lacking and even more inert by comparison.
Well, and the jokes are just so bad. They go on about four punchlines too long sometimes, where it's like, oh, talking about cars farting or cars thinking they're getting a venereal disease.
But I think, there's actually a scene where Terry Hatcher voices a plane and that she does a, oh, they're real. So like, you're making
Julie Bowen's character, I think.
Really? But wouldn't that make sense? Because Terry Hatcher's a voice. And it only makes sense if Terry Hatcher's plane is what they're
talking about.
I think Terry
Hatcher voices the forklift that tells Dane Cook that he can't. This is a ridiculous
sentence.
Why
are we wasting our time talking about this? But I thought the specificity of like, wink, 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 remember? That was a thing. And like, who the fuck remembers Terry Hatcher's voice?
Yeah, I guess so. And also weird, like,
he's not William
Hickey. Right. When I recognized Regina King, who's just killing it right now on all kinds of like amazing television. And it was weird to like hear her in this. But also I keep having to remember these are things, these are like paychecks. I mean, these are things that people can go in for like 2 hours in a voice booth, say all their lines and collect a big nasty check. And I was like, you know what? Get paid, Regina King.
Well, not,
like your
not
Netflix
just,
series only lasted one season.
Well, and that's, you know, royalties. I mean, Jesus Christ, I'm guessing that. I mean, God, I fucking looked at Wikipedia and Planes sold 4 million DVDs the year that it came out. I'm guessing it has been sold, you know, probably 3 million. So even though you make a shitty, 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 terrible movie, you can sell the crap out of the DVDs and sell the crap out of the merchandise. But it's, I don't know, it's depressing to me to see. And it does help. I mean, because when I posted this on Nathan Raven's Happy Place, people were very quick to point out that this was not a Pixar movie. And that is true. It's a spinoff of a Pixar movie. But it really does. I don't know. It kind of degrades the brand in the same way that, you know, Cinderella 4, Pajama Jammy Jam does not speak well of Disney and their integrity. Because, Pixar is the best. But when you have a hand and stuff this lazy and this perfunctory and this garbagey, it kind of brings down the whole entity just a little bit.
Yeah, it's true.
It doesn't make Inside Out any less awesome, but you know, Inside Out's awesomeness makes this seem even more pathetic by comparison.
It makes Pixar seem a little less indestructible.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I'll end with this scary image. Imagine a movie about live action people that had a visual gag about zooming through the parts of a living being to see him have a heart attack. Because that's basically what happens in Planes 2 at some point. And I'm like, what are we doing?
Well, I think what we've got to understand is that in the world of cars/planes, their understanding of what is and is not disturbing is completely different than ours. I'm sure that there are aspects of our human movies that would terrify them.
Disturb them, yes. Thank you, Charles, for that much-needed bit of cultural relativism.
I'm just saying, you need to try to step outside yourself when you're watching foreign cinema.
I do live in a human bubble. I need to see outside that experience. Yes, it's true. But enough about Planes too. Let's move on to even sunnier topics like death. All right, Nathan, you wrote a few big whoop pieces that kind of have an overarching theme. Why don't you talk to me about them?
Sure. Well, I write a lot about death. This has been a very, very big, and sad and horrifying month for death. I think we were all shocked and horrified by the suicides of Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain. Anthony Bourdain in particular was one of these people, sort of like Owen Wilson, who voiced Cars, sort of like Harris Whittles, where I thought, like, I remember very specifically thinking that person really has an amazing life. Like, I'm jealous. Like, they get to do everything that I want to do. They're good looking. They're funny. They're incredibly successful. They're beloved. They have friends. And then to see someone take their, I mean, they had gigs. I mean, Jesus Christ. I mean, they were doing it again. I was jealous. I envied his talent. I envied his good looks. I envied his success. So to see them commit suicide, I think is really, really jarring. And I think there's a sort of inherent cognitive dissonance because I think we people who are not famous, who are not rich, think if I had money, if I was on TV, if I was successful on that level, I would be so happy and I would be so contented and I would feel so fulfilled. So you can't understand why people who have what everybody is supposed to want to have would be not only not happy and not overjoyed, but so sad and so depressed and so filled with hopelessness that they're moved to kill themselves. And I remembered, you know, after that, that, you know, probably the moment in my life when I was unhappiness and when I was kind of most suicidal and when I was the most depressed and the most anxious, I was also the most successful. I mean, in 2011, I was writing for the AV Club. I was writing a book that would come, You Don't Know Maybe You Don't Like Me, for Scribner, which is a huge, huge publisher. I was writing Weird Al the book for Abrams. And I was so deeply, deeply, desperately unhappy. And all of the conventional things that I had, all the conventional signifiers of success, not only did they not make me happy, but they made me miserable. I mean, the pressure that I felt, the anxiety, the sense that I would fail my readers, that I would fail my editor, that I'd fail Weird Al Yankovic, it was overwhelming. So I think it kind of made me realize, too, that it's not that people commit suicide despite being successful and despite having these incredible accomplishments. A lot of times there's a connection between it, and people feel this intense, intense, intense pressure that they feel like the only way to escape it is to escape the world that it's such a huge part of. So that was one of the blog posts that I wrote. I wrote a blog post about the concept of not a fan, where when I worked at the AV Club, a lot of times in the comments, you know, there would be an obituary or whatever, and you'd see 15 people commenting, not a fan, but whatever, RIP. And that always irritated the fuck out of me, because I feel like in the aftermath of death, and it's different if somebody is a horrible, horrible human being, like when Jerry Sandusky dies, it's okay to say he's a piece of shit and he belongs in the burning and the ever fires of hell. But if somebody like, this is somebody I mentioned in my article, Nora Ephron was somebody who was hugely important to a lot of people. They loved her, you know, she was kind of a giant in a couple of different fields. She was supposed to be like a really funny and elegant and charming human being. And I just was not a fan of her movies. They just did nothing for me, but it would be really stupid and narcissistic and ego-based of me to be like, meh, not a fan, but whatever. Because you know what? Like, in that context, your non-fandom, you know, your apathy, your lukewarm feelings, like, they don't matter. And I'm not a huge fan of, you know, kind of these effusive and over-the-top sort of memorial things as well, but I feel like that's at least coming from a more honorable place than not a fan, which I think is prioritizing somebody's opinion over, you know, the genuine grief of people who are mourning. And then finally, I wrote a piece about the worst way to mourn people, which are terrible, terrible memorial political cartoons. I linked to a whole bunch of them on the website. Possibly my favorite / the most horrifying is St. Peter up at the gates of heaven, and he's saying to Anthony Bourdain, "What's cooking?" His beloved, and you know, Anthony Bourdain, the famous Christian, the very sentimental Christian. Oh, Jesus fucking Christ. So I guess kind of, what are you guys feeling in the aftermath of, you know, these two very, very devastating deaths and kind of the cultural conversation that's kind of built up around them?
It's interesting. The optimist in me wants to think that us reflecting on the death of Anthony Bourdain is opening up more discussions about how we view depression and how, like you said, you know, we shouldn't review it as like a temporary reprieve from success or a temporary setback, like that kind of thing, where even successful people are still very, very depressed, because that's not a cure. It's depression shouldn't be treated as something that is capable of being cured. It's a lifelong process. It's something that is treated and managed, and people who have depression deal with it every day of their lives. And we can't, you know, we have to just sort of be empathetic to that and give as much support as we can. I remember, you know, reading some blowback around that time from people who are depressed, who are sort of, they sort of felt alone in that they feel like people only pay attention when famous people die. I can understand the sort of resentment behind that, where it's like, you don't care about me because I'm not famous. But this person you didn't even know personally, you're leaving these really performative social media posts. And there is, and that's the thing, like, we all sort of feel compelled to perform that sadness in some way, whether, you know, even when we're really sad, like we know that we have that compulsion to post it on social media about, you know, R.I.P. Anthony Bourdain, and some sort of homily about, you know, the way it affected you, or, you know, go out and do something with no reservations, that kind of thing. And I was guilty of it myself. I mean, I did look up a lot to Anthony Bourdain as someone who is a lover of food and a lover of cooking. That's how I mostly related to him, is like, I have his La Halles cookbook. That was like the cookbook for his French bistro. And I'd been going through the last couple of years, like just picking off like recipes as best I could. So I was like, the best way I can think of to honor him myself is just to cook a really good dish from that book that I knew how to do. And so that was one way I was processing it. But I also felt myself feeling the need to like advertise that on Facebook and Twitter and everything, because otherwise I'm not involved in
the
discourse.
I think there's also a sense of, I'm grieving right now and it hurts. It helps to read about, to know that other people are feeling the same way, that this is a widely, I mean, like, you know, I guess David Bowie is probably the death that has kind of affected me the most these last couple of years. And yeah, I mean, Jesus, I fucking found out. I think it was like 7 o'clock, and I was looking at my phone for the first time, and I started weeping, you know. And it felt like it was important that us as a culture take a while to talk about what an important person this was, and how much they mattered to us, and, you know, how they gave a sense of hope and optimism to people who felt like outsiders. Yeah. So I think there's something positive, I think, but it can definitely go overboard. It can definitely be, and again, like, I think, you know, when people write their memorial tweets, they're not thinking about the, you know, number of likes or retweets they might get if they really nail what made somebody special. So yeah, I mean, I think grieving is a very human process, particularly grieving on the internet, where you're always going to see the ugly parts of people as well as the good parts. More the ugly parts, usually, even in the aftermath of death, which is, you know, what kind of the not a fan was kind of, or the I don't even know who this person was, or like, seriously, you want a fucking gold star and a pat on the head because you're like, I'm an expat, I have no idea who Anthony Bourdain is. It's like, really, that dude who's famous for traveling around the world? Yeah.
And also, you're typing this on a machine that has the breadth of the world's knowledge available to you. Like, just Google it. If you're really not that concerned, because otherwise, yeah, this is another instance of how social media complicates these discussions, because, and it has sort of happened, like, not even just in cases of, you know, of death and of tragic suicide, like, you know, it happened a couple weeks ago with the whole Kelly Marie Tran thing, where, like, yeah, you know, it's sad that Kelly Marie Tran felt like she was bullied to, you know, so much that she had to get off Instagram, but, you know, her character in The Last Jedi and Last Jedi was really the worst. And so people felt the need to, like, qualify their support of Kelly Marie Tran with, like, well, I didn't like the movie and her character, but it's not right that she was bullied. And I'm like, you realize there's nothing to do with the conversation, right?
And one of my mantras is, your opinion isn't that important.
Yeah.
And I say that to myself in the mirror every day, over and over and over again. It's a form of madness. But I feel that way. It's like, people are so connected to their opinion and so rooted in their opinion that they feel like to criticize their opinion or to disagree with their opinion is to attack them. Yeah. And that's insane to me. Like, you can fucking love what you love, and I don't give a mad ass fuck. I'm happy for you. I'm not attacking you. I just didn't care for Nora Ephron, you know?
Right, exactly. Yeah. So yeah, no, that whole not a fan thing. Yeah, again, like, I guess that's a more cynical instance of where I feel people performing a little bit.
Well, I was just saying, look at me. Like, my non-opinion about this is more important than somebody saying, "Hey,
look
I
how
was
much
really
I don't care about this."
Oh, totally. Yeah. Yeah.
Charles, what do you think about all this?
I am saddened by death. That's my hot take.
Yeah, right.
Death deeply
death,
sad.
Not no, a fan.
Celebrity suicides are always very difficult to process because there is a tendency to lionize people who are troubled, but then at the same time, you don't want to project a flattering light onto suicidal people as martyrs, because I think that glamorizes what is really a deeply ugly process. So I was feeling very ambivalent, but I did take this as an occasion to watch more of Anthony Bourdain's No Reservations, which is a great TV show. What a magnanimous guy. I saw the one where he goes to Tokyo, and he was someone who was very good about shutting up and listening when people were talking.
Well, and I think one of the things that he kind of exuded on those shows, which I really very much enjoyed, humility, was this real lust for life. You know, sense of like, I love eating, I love traveling, I love being in the company of other people. And I think that was really, you know, I think part of what made that so shocking was that somebody who had so much to live for and obviously was so passionate and so knowledgeable about so many things could have felt. It's also, oh my God, it's also disturbing, you know. Ugh, I feel like misogyny, you're always going to see that everywhere. And that in the aftermath of the Bourdain thing, they were kind of like, did Asia Argento push him to it by, you know, being with another dude? And I'm like, I feel so sorry for Asia Argento right now. The sheer number of death threats, rape threats you must be getting are horrifying. And that's the thing, too, is like when somebody dies, they leave behind this whole world and all of these people. And that remains, even though they're gone and their legacy remains. And I mean, like, yeah, when I went on to Amazon, you know, this morning, there was like three suggestions were Anthony Bourdain. And, you know, we sort of talk about Inside Out and how memories shift. You know, it's like, you know, like when I saw Obama when he was in office, like, very different from how I see him now, where there's such a sense of, I don't know, melancholy and the sense of nostalgia and why can't you come back? Why can't we have some sort of referendum where you're president now instead of Trump? I said there's no wrong way to mourn or to show grief. I've also sort of written blog posts about how irritated I am by people who say, oh, you know, this person professes to be sad because, you know, their partner just died or, you know, their friends were killed in a massacre. But look at this photo of them smiling and goofing around, taken a mere 17 days later. And I'm like, motherfucker, you have no right to tell people like, it's Argento. Like, you know what? She's going to be smiling because she's a fucking human being. She's going to be smiling because life is full of joy as well.
It sounds like those people need to watch Inside Out again.
Right. You know, and that they, yeah, she does not need to spend the next four decades of her life never smiling. Or people like, oh, I guess she really didn't care about that Weinstein thing. Oh, I guess she's, you know, she's F you to, yeah. It's, yeah.
And I bet those same people would respond positively to someone being like, don't mourn me too much when I'm gone. Like, still live your life, be happy. I don't know. And you know, we've been talking about Bourdain a lot, but then there was also the other, and that's probably because we have more relation to him than to the other famous person who tragically took their lives like the last couple weeks, which is Kate Spade. And that's something I've been trying to educate myself on too, because I mean, I never really knew her name outside of, you know, seeing, end caps at Target for her purses and stuff like
she's
that.
She's referencing but the impression pop songs occasionally. And she's David Spade's sister-in-law.
Oh,
yeah. Well, I totally thought it was just a sister, but it's, yeah, sister. Right. She's David Spade's sister-in-law. Yes.
All right. Well, the impression I get from people who have followed her stuff a little bit more is that like one of her major impacts was making, you know, sort of eclectic fashion more accessible to people, you know, introducing that kind of department store upscale kind of thing where you had this sense of quirky, playful, chic to something that to the kinds of places where you normally get very utilitarian, practical clothes. So there's like a sense of style, a sense of, you know, again, like accessible fashion to a lot of people. And that was,
well, and I think also there's this idea of that her brand was happy and her brand was quirky and her brand was upbeat and that didn't kind of work with kind of the intense pain and depression that she was working with. And again, I feel like one of the things we kind of learned is that people can get kind of trapped in perceptions, both in how they see themselves and how they see the world and how they see the world and how it looks at them.
And also taking these, you know, going back to the social media element, like sort of pairing our expressions of grief and loss and our sense and the emotions we're going through with, like, you know, our admittedly sometimes half-hearted attempts to address the problem, quote unquote, like, you know, posting the number for the suicide prevention hotline when, I mean, I was guilty of that. And then, like, I talked with other people.
I'm guilty of posting a suicide hotline.
I guess so. Well, I mean, but
guilty
like,
of murdering a child, not trying to, you know, offering people. But yeah, I can see where that would just be kind of like a performative gesture.
If that's
yeah.
the only thing you do, where, like, that's supposed to be really, like, the last resort when, like, and also the idea of, like, telling people who are depressed to just reach out will be there. But then also there's the double-edged sword of like, if we check in on people, if we feel the need to check in on people who we feel are depressed, just to like let them know we're here, that can also have a negative effect because, you know, then you feel like you're being treated in a very transactional way. So again, it's all very complicated. And I think we're stumbling through our discussions of how we can be of help or how we can seek help in times like this. And I think, you know, whenever someone who's so well known to so many people passes in this way, that opens up those discussions for better or worse.
For sure. I agree with you wholeheartedly.
All right. Well, with that sunny subject out of the way, let's move on. All right, let's finish up with happy places. Nathan, what's your happy place this week?
Well, yesterday was Father's Day, which was lovely, lovely, lovely. And we had a really, really nice Father's Day. There was a barbecue. There was swimming. And then probably my favorite part of it was I showed Declan, my 3.5-year-old son, I showed him the 1980s Teenage Ninja Turtles cartoon for the first time. It was available for $3.99 on Amazon. And it was gave me a lot of joy to kind of see it through his eyes for the first time. I was also very pleasantly surprised that it's actually pretty funny and entertaining. I think I just remember it as just being garbagey, mediocre, blah, blah, blah. But I actually fucking enjoyed it. And it was really lovely being able to kind of see it through Declan's eyes. And, you know, we're reading the Sesame Street Treasury. So it's been really, really nice kind of sharing things that I loved as a child and as an adult with my son. And I'm also very happy that I spared him watching Planes, Fire, and Rescue, which I think you would find really fucking boring, because it is very, very boring, even if you're 3.5 years old.
Did Dex respond in particular to anything for like in the Ninja Turtles cartoon? Was there anything like really popped out at him?
Yeah, I think Krang. He was very fascinated by
Krang?
The idea.
Krang. The kids love Krang.
They do. He's like, why does that brain? Why is he walking around? What's his deal? Yeah, his favorite word is why. So thankfully I have an answer to just about any time he asks why.
Yeah, that's good. Charles, what about you? What's your happy place?
Well, I've been a little sick over the past week, so I haven't had a whole lot of happy places. However, I'll tell you what is, I found solace on Netflix of all places over the weekend. I watched a romantic comedy known to some as a rom-com called Set It Up. Wonderful film. Very enjoyable. Zoe Deutsch and Glenn Powell, both of Everybody Wants Some, play personal assistants to a pair of very...
Hey, that's Leah Thompson's daughter? Or... Yeah, Zoe Deutsch. That's Leah Thompson's daughter, right?
Okay.
And she's her father is Howard Deutsch, who directed a lot of John Hughesy movies from the 1980s and 90s. And an episode of Tales from the Crypt.
Tremendous chemistry. It's a very entertaining film. It's really, really great. I give it a recommendation if you are the sort that likes romantic comedies. You know, it's a great example of the form.
What's the plot?
Right. So the two of them, they play personal assistants to a pair of very demanding, domineering bosses and in the same office building. And so following a meet-cute between these two assistants, they had a plan to set up their respective bosses romantically so that entanglement will keep the bosses busy and their jobs will be less demanding. You know, they'll have more freedom to do whatever they want. And so, you know, hijinks ensue after that. And believe it or not, a little bit of romance develops between these two would-be Cupids.
Ooh.
So it's the employer trap.
Yeah, pretty much. They name check Parent Trap and Cyrano de Bergerac. They're kind of on top of all of this. It's a very savvy movie like that. It's good stuff.
Despite having a really stressful week, I'm pretty greedy with my happy places. Just this past weekend, I got to see one of my very best friends and the officiant for my upcoming wedding get married himself in a very lovely ceremony outdoors in Libertyville. The place was beautiful and I got chewed up by bugs, but I didn't care. It was just lovely to see two lovely people get married and, you know, people I love very much and I feel very close to. Also, I found a great deal of happiness from another Netflix thing, season 2 of Queer Eye. I was never really exposed to the original show, but the recent Netflix reboot I'm a really big fan of because there is, again, like, you know, I'm responding to things that engender a lot of empathy and unity and that kind of thing. And the show very much dabbles in that where, yeah, there's the typical sort of Queenie going through people's closets and calling them not calling them slobs, but just like, you know, sort of making fun of the basic AF stuff they wear. But then they take the trouble to like dig down and be like, what makes you, you know, not care for yourself in these very specific ways? You know, there are these very simple things you can do to make your life easier, to feel more confident. And it comes from this place of like self-improvement rather than like molding you into what they want you to be. Unlike the original show, it's not just for straight people. Like a lot of the subjects, there was in the first season, there was a great episode with a closeted gay man who just needed a little help with his fashion and also the courage to come out to his mom. And in this season, there is a great episode with a recently transitioned transgender man. That's also a really powerful episode about identity and all that kind of stuff. And it's all just really, really heartwarming and uplifting. And yeah, sure, it's, you know, basic and commercial, you know, but it doesn't just say that, you know, all it takes for you to improve your life is several thousand dollars of free wardrobe and renovating your house. So I do enjoy that. But the last happy place I've got, again, I'm greedy, is this upcoming Wednesday in Chicago. I'm going to be hosting my very first Q&A as a film critic for a local film called Mercury in Retrograde, which I actually really like. It's from a local filmmaker named Michael Smith, who I know. And it's going to be at the Wilmette Theater on Wednesday. And so I'll get to do the thing where I get to introduce a movie and then ask the director questions and then try to field questions from other people. And hopefully they won't be too obnoxious. So that'll be great. I'm looking forward to that. It feels like a step. That pretty much wraps it up, Charles. Thanks so much for joining us. I really, really appreciate it.
Yeah, this was a delight. And thank you for suffering through planes, trains, and automobiles.
It was a pleasure. Total pleasure to be here on the program.
Awesome. Great.
And where can they find your stuff again?
Well, let's see. All of my work is sort of organized. You can find that on my Twitter account, which is Charles Bramesco. You can find it that way.
And you're working on a book, it sounds like?
Yeah. Well, I got a book coming in November, November 15th. I wrote a book about vampire movies, which is, I liked it, but nobody's ready yet. So I actually don't know if it's good or not. I hope it's good. I think it's good, but we'll see. Who knows? I got that coming up. But yeah, my work is regularly at Mike.com, The Guardian, Vulture, New York Times. Just Google it. I don't know.
I'm actually really, really jazzed with that vampire book. So
oh, yeah. Really I hope you like it. I talk about lots of fun movies. I discuss the movie where Dracula fights Billy the Kid at length. It's good stuff.
Awesome. What do you think is the most underrated vampire movie?
The most underrated? Well, see, that's tough. I love a lot of vampire movies, but let's see.
I feel like Martin would be one, except that that's pretty highly rated.
It's pretty solidly rated.
Yeah, perhaps.
I like Jess Franco's vampire movies. I like Vampiros Lesbos. I like Female Vampire. Those are kind of dumped on a lot, but I see a lot of charm in those.
As opposed to James Franco's vampire movies.
Yeah, that's a big distinction. You gotta be clear about that. James Franco's vampire
movies. He's more an emotional vampire.
He's a literal vampire there. A psychological vampire, yeah.
Perhaps.
Does Disaster Artist qualify as a James Franco vampire movie?
Only in a metaphorical sense.
That's true.
Oh, also he is vampire.
He is vampire.
That wraps it up for this episode of Nathan Rabin's Happy Cast. You can find me on Twitter at Alcoholhollywood and Nathan at Nathan Rabin. Subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes or your favorite podcatcher, and pledge to our Patreon at patreon.com/NathanRabinsHappyCast. Our theme song is by John Beacon. Check out his stuff at johnbeacon.com. Until next time, I bid you a hearty whoop whoop.